Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Jure Grieger, Cal Turner Chancellor's Chair of Wesleyan Studies and Distinguished Professor of Theology, and Rosemarie Henkel-Rieger, an organizer and lecturer who this semester is co-teaching a course with Jörg on religion, labor, and economics, about their recent book, Unified, We Are a Force, How Faith and Labor Can Overcome America's Inequalities. Thank you both for being willing to do this interview.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. Thanks for doing it.
So to start off with, how did you each get interested in issues related to labor? What circumstances pushed you in this particular direction?
So I'm a theologian, and for a lot of people it's surprising that I'm also involved in things, but that's the sort of theology that eventually formed in my mind, a theology that's always connected to real life issues, because I was trained in the academy in Germany, in the US, not to think about these things, and eventually I realized life and thought, theology and life and action and praxis are always related. And so I was looking around, what are the sort of issues where life is really condensed, where life comes together. And there are many issues today where you can see, you know, people struggling. So it's not just life as such, but it's really life under pressure, where people are trying to figure out what's going on, where is, you know, the common pain, perhaps. Mm. And so after a while, it occurred to me labor was a place where a lot of the things that we're all wrestling with comes together. So, for instance, you know, these days, of course, people are rightly concerned about issues of race, ethnicity, sexuality, gender. Those things all feed into labor because people who work experience various kinds of things, sometimes oppressions, pressures along these lines. So that's one thing. The other issue that also connects us is that 99% of the population are people who have to work for a living. So in the book, we call this the working majority. So talking about labor is not talking about somebody's special interest, but talking about what connects us, talking about where we experience common issues, common pressures, and sometimes common pain. So it felt like this was the place where a lot of it comes together. And so as a theologian, I'm engaging that because I think this is where life happens. And I'm trying to learn for my own field, for my own thinking, for my own writing, what is happening here. How does that reshape my images of God, of Jesus Christ, of the church? So it's sort of the place where it all comes together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so for me, I'd say it started out, I was active in the church for many years and working on all kinds of social justice issues that most churches are involved in, the homeless shelter and the mission trips and things like that. But I realized that while those are all good projects, they don't really bring about change. And so they're charity projects, which we need, right? People are hurting and they need help right away. So that's necessary, but it didn't go far enough for me. And so looking around, we moved to Dallas, and I was looking there for some place to plug into that made sense, and that's where I found Jobs with Justice. Mm. And this group brings together religious groups, community groups, and unions, labor, and to fight for economic justice. And so that's where I finally found a home, where I felt like, you know, this is where we can build power for workers, for the community, and bring about change. And so that's the way I came to this. Yeah.
Great. You've already kind of segued in a way to the next question I have, which has to do with the we in the title of your book, Unified, We Are a Force. which I take to be quite an inclusive we, and you've already said 99% of Americans. So what makes us, despite all of our differences, a we? How can you call us we?
Right, so Jorg kind of touched on that, I think, mm-hmm. already a bit, but we work is what we have in common, mm-hmm. 99% of us, and we spend so much time at work, right? So when we're kids and going to school, we're really preparing for work life, right? When we study, if we go to college, or apprenticeships, it's all preparation for work, and then, you know, a big chunk of our lives is taken up with actually working or trying to find work, and to support ourselves and our families. And then in retirement, we're recuperating, right, from work. So it really is, it takes up a lot of our life. We spend a lot of time there. And it's at work, too, where the identities that we have, you know, that make us unique and that are used to oppress us or give us privilege, intersect, and also where these identities are really used very successfully to divide us and to keep us from gaining power in any way. And so that's why, you know, we think it's good and necessary to focus on work, because this is, you know, is what connects us.
Mm-hmm. Another way of putting that too is it connects us and it divides us at the same time, because some people have an interest not to see that we, or not for working people to see the we. So some people would say, well, somebody's a supervisor, somebody's a worker,
right.
Or, you know, somebody's a professor and somebody's a janitor in the same building. What do we have in common? Well, the thing is, the 99% sort of approximate number, it's not a mathematical formula, but the majority of us are not independently wealthy. The majority of us have to work for a living. And what we do is basically fills up the bulk of our waking hours. So you spend the most of your time at work. And so in that sense, there is this community that we may not be realizing, because, you know, some people don't want us to see it, but it's there, and we don't have to create it. It's already happening. You know, people always complain about individualism. That's an ideology, but the reality is we're already and always connected, and work is one of those places. There's a theological component I would add to that, and that's what we're working out in this book as well. How do we think about God? And here, when you really push it, I think most people by default would think about God probably more in terms of, you know, maybe a CEO or a manager. Or in the old days, you know, you have the images of God as king, as a monarch, somebody who stands above all of the rest of us who work. What we're finding in our Abrahamic traditions, this is Judaism, Christianity, as well as in Islam, that there are many images where God is working too. So the we then is not just people, but it also includes the divine. To give you a few examples, in the creation stories that all of these traditions, all three traditions share, God is portrayed as a working person. In one of the reports anyways, where God plants a garden, God forms Adam from clay. What is not said is that God has some migrant workers plant a garden, you know, or have some scientists form Adam from clay. God is involved. Then in Christianity, of course, we have this thing that we never quite know what to do with, namely that Jesus was a worker. Jesus is born. Well, carpenter is what we usually hear, but the reality is this is more like a construction worker, a day laborer, somebody who's working on a big building project, who knows both work and probably also unemployment. So we have a lot of images in our traditions that also point us back to this we, who we are as community, as human beings, and who God is in relation to that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you argue in the book that work is under attack in the U.S. today. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you see it being under attack and how we got here. I mean, why was there a time when work wasn't was less under attack and now it's more under attack?
Yeah, good question. I think, you know, the very nature of work is changing, and a lot of jobs now are part of the gig economy, people call. What makes workers under attack in the gig economy is that there's no job security, right? You don't really have a boss. It's all kind of nebulous. If you work for Lyft or Uber, for example, it's hard to see, like, who's the boss, like, who do you go to if you have problems. And so, Lyft and Uber are making a profit, but a lot of times all the troubles that the drivers have, they have to take care of themselves. So if their car breaks down, it's their problem, right? And so they have lost revenue, but they still need to pay Uber and Lyft to be a part of that gig economy. So so that's one way that I think workers, you know, just don't have the security anymore. Like, our parents worked for the same company, you know, most of their lives, and had retirement and pension, or, you know, they had health care to a certain extent, and all of that, and a lot of that is just being chipped away and taken away from workers. So so that makes things really hard. Also, the right to organize, you know, for workers is being taken away. The right to work laws are being expanded. I think there are over 36 states that now have right to work laws, which mean that workers they don't have to join a union if they are employed at a workplace that is unionized, and so they get the benefits of the contract that the union negotiates, which oftentimes or most of the time raises wages and expands benefits and all, but they don't have to pay their fair share in making that happen. So what that does is it takes away the financial basis for unions and hard for them to survive. So those are just, a few things that show how workers are, more and more under attack.
And if you add to that, you look at what's happening to workers, you would also have to look at what's happening to communities. So as workers, see increased tensions at work, as they see fewer benefits, lower wages, less care that the companies are taking for them, you see the same thing in the communities. I think that's something that religious communities might have to think about too. We all complain about the breakdown of community. People have less time, to attend perhaps, but also people relate differently. People are not as communally oriented anymore. A lot of these things are shaped at work. So for me as a theologian, this is one of the questions. We're not just talking about work as a social issue, but how does what is happening at work shape us all the way to the core? How does it shape us, when we're back in our families? How does it shape us when we're in communities? How does it shape us when we're in church or other religious communities? And it's not just for Christianity. So in that sense, the attack that you're seeing against work and workers has tremendous consequences for all of our lives. Now, we spend a lot of time in Dallas. This is where we spent the past 22 years before coming to Nashville, working with various low-wage work groups. So most recently, we worked with a group of Walmart workers. And this sort of exemplifies what we're worried about. What is happening at Walmart is, people are under a great deal of pressure. Wages are low. And most people are not getting to work full-time, because that way the company doesn't have to pay benefits, the company doesn't really have to act as if these were their workers. So they're always hanging on, and there are all kinds of issues that workers have to deal with in their everyday life. So if you look at working conditions at Walmart, they're one example for how work is getting worse, how work is under attack. But what we learned at Walmart, we put it in this phrase. We said, as goes Walmart, so goes the economy. So in that sense, this is a test case. It's a laboratory setting where you can observe some of these tensions. But then you have to ask yourself, what is happening elsewhere? What is happening in other places of work? What is happening all the way to the university? Do we see some of what we would observe in the lives of these Walmart workers and people working at a university? And this is not a complaint about individuals, you know, saying they're bad employers or things, but these are big structures. And as work is under attack in that way, life becomes under attack. Communities, broader organizations, and that's what we're worried about.
Right. So, I mean, this is probably, you know, worth books of material. But how did this happen? How did the, you know, the our parents or grandparents have pensions, have this kind of security? How did we get where we are? I mean, that's a huge question, but I mean, do you have any kind of sense of through your own experiences, why this is happening or how this is happening?
So the first thing you have to say is that the sort of benefits that we once enjoyed, and most of our parents and grandparents mm-hmm. did, they did not come out of nowhere. So this is not something that was always there and always eroding. A lot of that in the United States, you know, came to pass when workers started to look at their lives. Workers started to organize. Workers then, through unions, with the support of churches about 100 years ago, organized to have weekends off work, to have a 40-hour work week, to have pensions and benefit plans, all the way to Social Security. None of this was given by benevolent people who had a dream, but this was something that workers realized they needed for their well-being, for the well-being of their communities. And by organizing together and, you know, then lobbying, making demands, having conversations not only with their employers but also with politicians, a lot of this happened. And so in the U.S. I think we oftentimes forget that a lot of what we're enjoying, our freedoms, all the way to our rights to vote and all of that, comes from organized people. You know, the reason why women now have the right to vote is because of the suffragists, women who organize. And a lot of what we're enjoying in the labor world comes from that as well. And the fact that it's eroding shows, I think, another story that Rosemary might want to comment on.
Yeah. I mean, I guess a lot of people know the New Deal, right? Was a time period when workers were guaranteed a lot more safety and respect, and through laws and that. And then through World War II, there were another time where workers, you know, there's a lot to produce and what, and the economy was changing there. And after World War II, workers still, through unions, through being organized, had a lot of power and could leverage that. And that helped create, you know, the middle class that we so, you know, aspire all to be and move into. But slowly, you know, the bosses, the corporations, you know, realize that a lot of money, a lot of the profit they're making is going to workers, and that profit could be siphoned off for their benefit, you know. And so laws were rolled back slowly, and so wages kind of increased along with productivity up until about the 70s, and then we saw the stagnation of wages while productivity still increased. So workers were, you know, pulling their weight in the economy, they were being more productive, but the value they created for the economy was not given back to them in the form of higher wages and benefits and and the like, but was siphoned off to the top, which has created this great inequality that we now have in the economy.
And so this is the subtitle, you know, inequality is mentioned there. How do what do we do about it? We want people to know that this is a situation that is sort of almost unique in history. People say, well, inequality is rising, everybody knows the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. What we don't know is how it compares to other periods. So today, for instance, the top 1% has basically control of 40% of the wealth of the country. This is the contemporary United States. It was not always like that. Like Rosemarie says, you know, if you look back in our own history, it wasn't always that divided. Now, for me, a really striking comparison is all the way back to the Roman Empire. You know, theologians have this long memory, deal with the history. And this is, of course, when the church now grows and develops. Well, a little bit later, you know, kind of the times of the early church, about the year 150 after Christ, you have a wealth inequality where the top 1% controls 16% of all wealth. So in the Roman Empire, the top 1% controls 16%. Today, the top 1% controls 40%. So inequality here is actually significantly worse than it was in the Roman Empire. And that's not just a social commentary, but it shows you how life develops. It shows you how our faith is shaping up. It shows you how sort of our imaginary takes certain things for granted. And what we're saying is, once you start addressing this, all kinds of things happen. It's not just a matter of changing the world, it's also a matter of changing the way you think, the way you relate to people, the way you do your theology. Again, this is why I'm doing this as a theologian.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk a little bit in the book about some areas where you think, and I don't know that you put it exactly like this, but labor activism is falling short. And, for example, you talk about a focus on distribution rather than production, and a tendency towards, and you talk about this for a considerable part of the book, a tendency towards advocacy rather than solidarity. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about some ways, including these, ways in which you see labor activism at present falling short, and maybe some suggestions about how labor activists might sort of renew their thinking on some in some areas, or their practice in some areas.
Right. So a lot of this relates certainly to labor activism, but we would argue it really relates to activism more broadly. Mm-hmm. So if people hear labor, they think, well, this is a very specific activism, but we're thinking this is the sort of thing that you find in other social movements as well, you know, whether it's the Occupy Wall Street movement or several other movements that we had, that we still have in recent times. So what we're suggesting is this. In the situation of inequality, a lot of people are, of course, worried about distribution. So they say, if it's as unequal as we know it is, we need to redistribute the wealth. And that's, of course, you know, it's a reasonable proposal to say, if some have so much and others have nothing, to the degree that it's really almost an epidemic. In the city of Dallas, Texas, for instance, 38% of all children are living below the poverty line. 38% of children in the city of Dallas, Texas. This is not a country in Africa. This is not a country in Latin America. In the United States, Dallas, Texas, 38% of children are living below the poverty line. So talking about distribution and redistribution makes a lot of sense. But we're suggesting we're needing to take another step back. So it's not just about distribution. It's really how did this happen? How come things are distributed so unequally? And we're saying a lot of that has to do with how we value people's production, what people are doing. So a worker, for instance, we were talking to some workers in construction in Nashville recently. We have a construction boom. A worker makes, can you remember the numbers, Rosemarie? Maybe $15 an hour.
Yeah, I think it's like 15 to 20.
Mm-hmm. And that worker does important work, but the worker then tells us the money that the employer makes off the worker's work is like three times higher. So here we're saying, why don't we take another look at production? What people are actually doing, what they're accomplishing, what difference they're making, and actually pay people what they're worth, you know, pay people their true value. That is another way of addressing the problem of mal and misdistribution, but you can now say, you know, we don't have just to talk about this, we talk about the sources of it. So here, the shift from conversations about distribution to production is simply a reminder we have to talk about who is actually making a difference. You can talk about an automobile plant. You know, Tennessee, we have some of those. You could say, well, what is the contribution that a worker makes in one of these automobile plants? Well, one thing we know for sure is that a CEO cannot build a car by him or herself. You know, you can CEO all day and not a single thing gets built. So how do we value people who are actually building things? That's the sort of question. And we are arguing that there is really a lot of conversations that need to be had, and that can be productive, forward-looking, hopeful. Rosemary might want to say a bit more about production. We need to come back to the advocacy issue in a minute.
Yeah, I mean, just tagging along with what Jorg said, you can see it too in like the ratio of CEO pay to worker pay. It's what, like over 300 times more, and that's just the average. And investment brokers, it's like 1,000-fold higher. So there is great inequality, and right, and in looking at having a more holistic view about what workers contribute and valuing that, it wouldn't just be reflected in their pay necessarily, but then to be concerned about their safety and their health, you know, on the job. Like construction workers, they oftentimes have to buy their own safety gear, and they usually don't get a whole lot of money for that, right? They're not, a whole lot is left over after the bills are paid, so they have substandard, you know, safety gear and things like that. So valuing the worker, you know, would contribute to all of that too. Are they healthy, you know, on the job? And that makes for healthy communities too. So it's, you know, it goes beyond just the individual worker.
So as for activism, we're saying we really have to get a clearer picture of what the problems are. How do we go back to what causes the symptoms that we're seeing today? Advocacy is one of the things, of course, that activists embrace, and we're saying it's a good thing. So, you know, the churches oftentimes get stuck with charity. So then people say, well, we don't just help people. We have to speak out. We have to speak out for them. We have to advocate for those who are not treated well in this situation. And if you look at, say, Jesus' own ministry, you could say Jesus is more into advocacy than charity. When Jesus preaches good news to the poor, as he does several times in the gospel, he's not just talking about soup kitchens, he's talking about good news to the poor, which is they will no longer be poor. That's good news to the poor, as far as we can see. And so you can see Jesus speaking out. What we're suggesting, though, in addition, and maybe one step further than advocacy, is what we're calling deep solidarity. And that is the recognition that even those of us who speak out for others may be more in that same boat with those others than we have ever realized. So the advocates sometimes put themselves above other people. They think, well, we are privileged, we speak out for the underprivileged. People in this deep solidarity mode are people who realize we have something in common that we hadn't seen before. This is why we're emphasizing so strongly that we're the working majority. So even me, as a named chair university professor, I have ultimately more in common with the person that's cleaning these buildings than with this top 0.1%, you know, that controls all this wealth. And so here, deep solidarity is simply a reminder that whatever we're doing, charity or advocacy, we need to think of ourselves as being in community, being together, being sharing some of these struggles. Now, this is not a way of making everybody look alike. We're not saying, well, therefore we're all the same. This deep solidarity now allows us to make use of our differences. Now we can say, you know, I'm doing what I'm doing as a university professor, quite proud to be in that place. I'm sharing, you know, some of my limited resources, whatever I have, with others. And then other people do what they do from their other perspectives, you know. And this is, of course, then we're also differences of race, gender, ethnicity, sexuality come in, because this is something that everybody has to contribute. And what we're also saying is, in this deep solidarity, we have to pay attention to those people who are enduring the greatest pressures. So for me, paying attention to a black Walmart worker in Dallas, Texas, this is what we've done for so long, teaches me something that I cannot easily see from my perspective as a university professor. So deep solidarity then is, we have to learn from each other, and the guides and the teachers are often those people who are in the trenches. So in that sense, we still need advocacy, we still need to speak out, but it's not like we're separate.
Now, you've already talked a little bit about how religion would benefit from a renewed focus on issues of labor. I mean, you've talked a bit about how we conceptualize God, for example, as a worker, or Jesus as a worker. What are some of the other ways in which you would see religion benefiting from a focus on labor?
So since I'm a theologian, I of course think about theological images. So the images, the examples you just mentioned, that comes to mind first. You know, we think about our traditions differently. So it's not a matter of getting rid of our traditions, but really thinking differently about what is it that our sacred scriptures are saying. You know, what is it that some of our forefathers and foremothers are saying. So that's one thing. The other thing that I think is really important is to understand that religion is somehow also a movement. Religion is not just something that happens in people's heads or that happens when people sit in pews in churches, but religion is something that happens when people move forward together. In the New Testament, the book of Acts, for instance, talks about Christians as the people of the way. So this is an active thing. This is a community thing, where religion is not something that you can limit to an hour on Sunday morning, or to certain rituals, or to certain things that you believe in your head, but it's a whole way of life. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that is the other piece where I think religion gets revitalized in a way that it cannot do it for itself. So everybody wants to have religion revitalized these days, because it's getting a little boring, you know, and young people don't like it anymore. Well, in that sense, I think religion can learn a lot from what's happening all around it. So religion doesn't have to pull itself up by its own bootstraps, as it were. Religion can learn from other movements. Why is that the case? Well, theologically, I would say because God is a lot bigger than what we usually imagine our own religious communities to be, our own churches to be, our own ideas to be. So if God's actually at work all around us, and we are saying God is also at work in these movements to some degree, then we need to pool our resources, our energies, and we're actually hopeful that this is a way forward for all of us.
Mm-hmm. So going the other direction, which is what you do in the book, what resources do religious traditions make available for the labor movement? And I wanted to tack on a question about how you take a diverse movement like the labor movement that does include people who have no religious commitment. How does this movement, this diverse movement, make use of such religious resources while maintaining its diversity? I mean, what can the movement take from these religious traditions?
Good question. You know, one thing too is if you look at the religious community, they're workers too, right? Mm-hmm. So that, you know, it really includes it includes everyone, and I think things that churches and religious communities can do for labor is, you know, that they're organized, right? Sunday school and, you know, worship and what, to talk about worker issues and worker rights issues. And we know a lot of people, and Jorg's like asked groups of labor leaders, you know, stand up or raise your hand if you're part of a church community, and most people's hands go up, especially in the South. And then he oftentimes asks, well, how many of your pastors know you're a union member? And hardly a hand goes up. And so there's like, the people aren't talking, you know, mm-hmm. they're not taking like their problems of work to the church. And so this, I think, would be a real fertile ground to talk about a lot of these economic justice issues that people face. So mm-hmm. so I think that's, you know, one way the church could be real fertile ground.
I want to talk about the diversity issue that you're raising, mm-hmm. because in the book we're talking about the three Abrahamic religions, mm-hmm. so it's Judaism, Christianity, as well as Islam. And what we're saying is, this is a place, and this is not a comment that the other religious traditions wouldn't have anything to say to, but we just had to limit our project to three. There is, in Buddhism, a school that's called Engaged Buddhism that's also very much related to what we're doing, and we've had relationships with them as well. But the thing about diversity is, if you have a common project, a common movement, it doesn't have to be a narrow movement. It could be a movement. I mean, the labor movement is not that narrow, really. Mm. And labor recently is reclaiming something that's always been part of it, that's been overlooked for some time, that labor is not just about salaries and benefits at work, but it's really a community thing, because if working people are doing better, the communities are doing better. So the labor movement is recovering some of this. But when you have a common cause that may be broad, that may be just you know, broadly related to the community, then you can actually bring your diversity to bear in a different way. So, for instance, what we've seen in the labor movement ourselves is, you know, when you have an action, when you have, say, a protest, and you bring people from different communities together, including different faith communities, we can actually start listening to each other. There's something that, say, some of our Jewish friends see much clearer than those of us who are Christians. And so as we now compare notes, we learn something in the process. Or somebody from a Muslim tradition might come in where there's some really strong insights and awarenesses that the rest of us don't know. I mean, for instance, as some of our Muslim friends have pointed out, the term jihad, this holy warfare that people in the West are so worried about, really in the Muslim tradition means working for justice. So here, you know, a strong commitment to working for justice is something that can be really revitalizing for other communities that, you know, Christianity these days focuses so much on charity that justice sometimes gets left out. Mm-hmm. So in this sense, you can actually put some of these differences to work without necessarily having to identify them or to say, well, we're exactly the same. So we can accept the fact that we bring different resources, they all help, we learn from each other, learn something about ourselves, but we don't have to declare identity. It's not necessary. The movement doesn't have to have one ideal leader, it doesn't have to have one ideal ideology either. It brings it all together in moving forward. So I have argued in other places that this may be the ideal place for ecumenical dialogue between different Christians. Mm. It would be the ideal place for interreligious dialogue between different religious traditions, non-Christians, and you know, many other sort of perspectives come together here, because it's so much more vibrant than sitting around a table and talking about ideas. Once you put them to the test, once you put them to use, in your struggle, in your movement, you actually see what they're doing, and you're developing new respect for it. Mm. Sometimes you're developing new respect for your own ideas, which is quite impressive too. But there's really no need, I mean, the way we see these movements shaping up, there's really no need for, you know, any sort of narrow ideas of identity or similarity or sameness. Diversity is quite fruitful in these settings.
Mm-hmm. In the last chapter of the book, you share some of your experiences with labor organizing in Dallas, and you've already talked a little bit about being in Dallas and doing work there. Though you haven't been in Nashville long, what are some of your impressions about how this city compares with Dallas with regard to labor organizing, and how do you think the recent election results will affect the labor movement in the near future?
Yeah, well, we're really excited to be in Nashville, and it's a really, from what we can tell, you know, so far, we've been here a few months, but there's a really vibrant labor community. It's a lot smaller than in Dallas, you know, which is natural. They're, you know, not as big a city, but there are a lot of great people who, you know, are engaged beyond like their immediate, you know, workplace-related struggles. So the Central Labor Council here in Nashville, we've known a lot of the people for a while and got to know some more people. So they're engaged in all sorts of community-wide struggles and really working to build a better Nashville for everyone, really. And so just to name a few organizations, there's Nashville Organizing for Hope and Action, or Action and Hope, NOAA.
I was just hearing someone talk about that over at my office.
And so the labor, organized labor is a part of that movement, and they work on, you know, all sorts of issues from, you know, better jobs here in Nashville to, you know, dismantling the prison pipeline. So labor's heavily engaged. There's the Workers' Dignity, a Workers' Center, those are just a few groups, but you know, there are a lot of great people here, and it's really exciting to plug into that work.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting for me, again speaking as a theologian, coming here, and this is our first semester, so we've only been here a few months, mm-hmm. don't know everything yet. But I have to go on record saying this is good, this is going to be recorded, that the first groups that invited me and Rosemary to speak were labor groups, not religious groups. Hmm. So we talked about religion and labor to the Central Labor Council here in Nashville. You know, this is interesting, mm-hmm. That the churches were not the first ones coming to knock at our doors. Mm-hmm. So there's something going on. That's one thing. NOAA was already mentioned. I also need to mention Vanderbilt Divinity School. This is a place where these conversations are happening. Rosemary and I are teaching this course together that you mentioned earlier on theology, economics, and labor. And we have a large enrollment. We have 34 students in a seminar that's usually limited at 20. Mm. And so we find there's a real strong concern for bringing all these things together. And I think this is the important thing about the book. It's not just a book about the labor movement. It's not just a book about religion. It's really talking about how these two movements can learn from each other, you know, mm-hmm. or the various, more than just two, but, you know, coming from two different directions. Religious movements, social movements can learn from each other, and how this ultimately brings new excitement to what we're doing. And we're finding some of this excitement here in Nashville. That's quite fascinating. Since you asked the question about the election, we have to get to that, but this is the other thing that we've seen. You know, just in recent days, we have been part of various events, you know, marches, actions, and a lot of them organized by Vanderbilt students. And again, this is Vanderbilt University, but the Vanderbilt Divinity students are oftentimes in the leadership. They're the ones who know what to do. They're the ones who have some of the ideas, and they're also the ones who are recognized by the community. My hope is really that this is not just because we may be the better organizers, but because we have a deep faith, we have a deep confidence that there is a future together. There is a future that goes beyond some of the struggles that we have seen recently. Now, from a labor perspective, as well as from other perspectives, there is not necessarily a lot of time to relax here, to say, well, it's going to be okay, because we have seen a lot of attacks on labor. We talked about these earlier. They were not just attacks on workers, but also on the labor movement. It's very hard in the United States to even form a union. This is something that's in violation of the United Nations Human Rights Declaration, that actually argues that people need to have the right to have a union. I'm a United Methodist. This is something that goes against the social principles in United Methodism, where the Methodist Church clearly states that people have to have the right for collective bargaining. Now, we'll have to see how this continues, and if somebody listens to this a few years down the road, they'll see what happens. But we're worried about this. You know, these things that religious communities, that international global communities are supporting, might be under attack as well. We don't quite know for sure yet, but that's what we're worried about. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we have a lot of evidence that people are organizing and continuing the good work that they've been doing for a long time.
Well, that ends the interview on a slightly optimistic note. So, again, Jürgen, Rosemarie, thank you for this conversation. I've been talking with Jürg Rieger, Cal Turner Chancellor's Chair of Wesleyan Studies and Distinguished Professor of Theology, and Rosemarie Henkel Rieger, an organizer and lecturer who this semester is co-teaching a course with Jürg on religion, labor, and economics, about their recent book, Unified, We Are a Force, How Faith and Labor Can Overcome America's Inequalities, published by Chalice Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.